Today's talk is given by Professor James Frew of the University of California, Santa Barbara. Professor Frew is an Associate Professor of Environmental Informatics in the Wren School of Environmental Science and Management at UCSB and a Principal Investigator in UCSB's Earth Research Institute, ERI. A geographer by training, he has worked in remote sensing, image processing, software architecture, massive distributed data systems, and digital libraries, probably amongst many other things. His current research is focused on science data citation and curation, geospatial information provenance, and applications of array databases. And this is actually his second year-long sabbatical in Edinburgh. I can remember your previous one. And he does, however, hopes to retire before becoming eligible for a third one. So having been a friend to us here and to the series over this time, we would hope to see you back again for a third time in some capacity, presently a leisure capacity. But in the meantime, we look forward to his second interesting talk in a trilogy of four.
Well, thanks for the intro. That's where I come from when I'm not here. Actually, this is an old picture, so my office is where this parking lot is.
It's a nice place.
But
Edinburgh's a nice place, too.
All right, so this could be kind of an idiosyncratic talk. I note with some trepidation, a mix of trepidation and relief, that there is significant Adena presence back there in the Crisps Gallery. So I expect catcalls and contradiction and whatever from you guys. This might be a little bit low level for you. I'm not going to go down into the weeds on data curation. Instead, it's going to be kind of a grab bag. I'm going to talk about some of my experiences, some of the opinions and prejudices I've developed about what's involved with curation. And the goal is to sort of make you think about the problem. Maybe some solutions, not so much. Feel free to interrupt anytime. I've been lecturing for God knows how long, so I'm used to people interrupting, nodding off. I will throw things at people that are snoring. So. Okay, before we get into curation, let's just get out of the way what's special about geospatial data. And this is like a direct crib from the ISO standard for preservation of geospatial data. I think this is an actual real standard. I yanked this out of a draft that somebody sent me, and they probably weren't supposed to because we're supposed to do that. But anyway, so what is special about it? Well, the first 3 years, all I have to do with geospatial data is reference the Earth somehow, right? There's a piece of the Earth. There are coordinate systems and transformations between them you have to keep track of. Maps are involved in the visualization. The rest imply that geospatial data is usually useless unless it's linked to some other kind of data context. Attribute data living in a database, for example. Geospatial data tends to be voluminous. Okay? I mean, the way I try to get my students to think about that is that if you divide the Earth up into square kilometers, about half a billion of them. Okay? So anything you do at the even at kilometer scale for the whole Earth, you know, scales up by half a billion. You know, just do math. So you know, it's very easy to make geospatial data multiply. Double the resolution, quadruple the amount of data you're dealing with. And then finally, you can have multiple levels of detail in the same data set. So these are all things that can kind of make your life interesting if you're dealing with geospatial information. This talk is not going to be specifically about geospatial information, except in some examples. Because despite the fact that, you know, I just spent all this time telling you that geospatial information is really special, all kinds of information are really special. Okay, just like geospatial information has coordinate systems you have to keep track of, other kinds of information have things like protein sequences that you have to keep track of. All right, so all of these things have rich context associated with them. What's driving this, despite the fact that, you know, as we walk across the floor, we have to kick bits out of the way to get from one side of the room to the other? How we think about science data is changing. Right? We expect science data to be discoverable now. Expect it to be contextualized, and I'll belabor this point to a considerable amount, just a little bit. We expect it to be available, not just, wow, is this open? I didn't even notice this. There's a tape. There's an actual tape in there. Okay, well, hang on. This will, you'll see why I was excited about that a little bit. Right. I had no idea that there were any of those still in existence. Okay, we expect it to be available as opposed to living on a tape somewhere. We expect it to be usable by the tools that we are using, not to have to learn a whole new tool set in order to work with data. we expect it to be identified and citable. I mean, only recently in my case, but now it's sort of just all just sort of becoming part of the ante to play this game. And we expect it to be linked into the scholarly literature. We expect it to be a first-class publication. Right? So, what is curation? Well, here's one definition pulled out of a paper from a library conference a while back. And this is as good a one as any of the ones I've seen. But if you read through it, I'm not going to read it to you. I think all of you guys sort of read it the grade level or whatever that's written at. Basically what is being described here is a process that works over time. Okay? And this is important to wrap your head around. Curating information doesn't mean sticking it on a shelf and just making sure that the air doesn't get too dry or too damp and that large bugs are kept out. All right? Curating implies a process of continual adaptation. It doesn't imply this, okay, which is, this is a diagram of the nuclear waste depository in New Mexico, okay, where you go down 2,000 feet and you put your nuclear waste there and it stays there forever, all right? Put the data in the salt mine. It'll be there 2,000 years from now, but it won't be terribly useful, all right? So this is not what we're talking about. It's not the idea to put your data in a salt mine. Instead, the idea is, and I just arbitrarily busted it up into these three pieces. Everybody I know who plays this game has a diagram or an outline or something that boils curation down into n steps, where n is usually some number strictly less than 10. I just boiled it down into three steps to make it easy to talk about for the sake of this, but this is not to say that this is the be-all and end-all model of how this works. But I would say that if you're curating information, keeping it around for a while and making it usable for a while, first, you got to make sure you describe it. That's this contextualization, putting it in context so it means something. Second, you have to preserve it. You've got to save it so it hangs around. And finally, you have this process of adaptation and presentation that makes it usable and continues to make it usable. And all these things are processes. Okay, it's not like, whoop, described, done, I get to go home now. Okay, you're always going to find out new stuff about it, or you're going to find out that some of your description was bad and needs to be redone. All of these things are stuff that keeps going on. It's important to bear that in mind. All right, so let's look at these components in a little more detail. I'm kind of talking like an auctioneer, aren't I? I should probably slow down a little bit. So, context. I think I got this equation from, I want to say, Elliot Christian, the guy that used to work for OCLC. Any of you guys with roots in the curation community remember this cat? Anyway, he once told me, and he told me this over several beers, so he might be not want me to be quoting him on this, but basically he said, context is metadata. Metadata is context. Anybody who starts spouting at you something about metadata and you think they might be trying to pull the wool over your eyes, try this simple test. Just substitute the word context for everything they're saying when they say metadata, and if what they're saying doesn't make sense, it didn't make sense before. They're really the same thing. The only fine distinction that I would make for computational purposes would be that metadata is a representation of context. Metadata is when you take information and purpose it so that it provides context for other stuff. There's no such thing as metadata. My name is not metadata. It's usually used as metadata for me to help identify a person. But my name could just as easily be data in a study for, why a guy whose last name is Frew, who should be from somewhere, not too far away from Sterling, in fact, lives in California. Okay? So at that point, it's data and not metadata. So it's just a matter of how it's being used. When you are using data to provide context for other data, it's metadata. Context is required for comprehension. So the big question you're asking yourself when you're gathering context for information is, how much context do you need in order to make sense out of it? So let's look at some examples here, and we're going to start with probably the most remote examples possible. Anybody recognize that? It's not a dried out bacon, buddy.
That's cuneiform.
It's cuneiform, yes. Yeah, all right. Professor in the front row. Okay, somebody besides the professor in the front row. Good. Cuneiform, all right. Okay, this is a Sumerian tablet. And in fact, it is legible. It is a receipt for the delivery of beer. Okay? I mean, just pause and appreciate that for a second. One of the oldest artifacts of writing, of written communication that we have, is records the delivery of beer. Okay? I mean, that's wonderful. I'm sorry. This is like 4,000 years old. I'm giving dates to like one significant figure here, so it's not. It's 4,000 years old. To one significant figure, it is that old. That's really old. And yet, we know it. First of all, it survived. Okay. Is anybody thinking quickly enough to realize that the only reason this survived is because it was buried not 2,000 feet down, but way deep down? And I just said, you know, bury stuff. Well, I'll be buried and we dug it up. Okay, so, you know, there's an exception to everything. Right. But nonetheless, we dug it up. We could read it. You know, at least some people can read it. You know, this information has survived. Okay, let's accelerate a little bit. Anybody recognize that? Not you. Okay. Anybody else?
I think that says Copernicus on it.
Yes. You can read. Okay, yeah. Can you read the rest of this stuff, though? There might be some people in this room that can do it. Don't people, like, still learn Latin over here sometimes? My brother learned Latin in high school. I think he was the last living student in California to learn Latin. Anyway, this is, in fact, Copernicus's. This is the first letterpress edition of the Copernicus, and I actually put a nice standard citation to it up there, even though I think the publisher has gone out of business. But, so you can't order another one from it. But if you want to see this one, you can go up to the Edinburgh Observatory. Okay, there's a wonderful library up there that has just amazing, you know, old stuff, including this, which is where I took this picture. So this is about 500 years old. And there are people alive who can read this. A lot of people can read this. More importantly, they can read it and make sense out of it. Okay, it's describing concepts that are still current, still part of our culture. Now, everybody should recognize this. Okay, because you can read it, right? It's in English. As long as, you know, you realize that F's are S's sometimes. Actually, I think back then everybody said professor instead of professor, right? That's why I took that way. Note also for you geographers that this guy's address was next to the Fleece Tavern. I'm not cooking these examples, it just keeps coming up. Okay. So this is the first edition of Halley's treatise on comets. This one is about 300 years old. Trust me, you do the math for it. Okay, so the point is that a lot of context exists already. It's out there in your heads. Okay? I didn't have to give you a whole chunk of metadata for this for you to look at this page and realize what this was about. You've all heard of Halley and comets. You probably did what I did when I saw this in the flesh. Wow, Halley's book about comets. You know, like, how cool is that? Right? So just because we don't have a massive bibliographic description here, a physics or an astronomy textbook, and all that other stuff, doesn't mean that this information is useless. There's a lot of context that still exists for it. Right? Let's go digital. Okay. I'm just going to throw some random data at you. Ooh. How about that? Or that? Okay? Anybody see the connection?
So it's the same number. We got pi.
It's all the same thing. That bit pattern up there, as expressed as binary, is being successively interpreted as hexadecimal, 4 bits interpreted as hexadecimal, as ISO Latin characters. That's a control O in there. I didn't know how to write a control O, so. But all these other characters are what it would be. As an unsigned integer, as a signed integer, and as a floating point number. Okay, that's that. That is just taking that bit pattern and laying some extremely elementary metadata on it, like what hardwired capability of this computer is to be used to interpret this bit pattern. Okay, and yet absent metadata, how am I supposed to understand this? I might look at this and go, well, duh, okay, how likely is that to occur by accident? See how I did this. I cooked this example. I started here and worked back. But, you know, mean, without that elementary bit of metadata, you're hosed. You have to guess. Okay, let's go even closer to home. That looks familiar, doesn't it? You guys all like use the Linux command line and stuff. Okay, now, you guys are all geographers. What's going on here? What is that?
Shapefile.
Yeah, okay. There's nothing up there as a shapefile. Okay.
SHP.
That's my point, okay? You know that. You have that context in your head that says, well, there's an SHP there, so it must be a shapefile. Is this, in fact, a usable shapefile, just based on the files that are there? What's missing? Well, okay, here we go. Let's take a look. Okay? So if I run a command, which we'll come back to, and look peek inside that shapefile, it says, whoa, it's a shapefile. And it has a name, foo. Very useful. It has metadata associated with it. The metadata is just when the DBF was last updated. It's got all this other stuff. So me just looking at this, you know, poking it at it, going, you know, speak to me. What do I see? I see, well, does it have a coordinate system? It has some coordinates in it. Right? Can I make sense out of this? I don't know. These things here look state fips, kinfy fips, fips, scoomy, poppy, whatever. What does all this crap mean? You know, just looking at it, I mean, clearly it means something to somebody. But now let's suppose, you said, suppose I stick a purge file in there. This file purge pops up. I have no idea what it means. Now I poke it and I see, whoa, look at all this stuff. All of a sudden this information pops up in here that says, Greenwich, GCS North American. Okay, something's happening here. There's more information. Nothing else appears to have changed. Now suppose I just, and again, this is like, you know, data waterboarding, right? I'm just poking this, trying to make it talk. I go, what's going on here? Whoa, I drop it into a GIS and I see something. Right? Well, I didn't get garbage or a picture of Bozo the Clown. I got something. And again, put yourself in mind of a Martian, okay, who's looking at this data and may not recognize this particular shape. Okay, now we add this. I don't know what's going on with that. So I peek inside this file, and I see a bunch of crud. All right, but buried in this crud, I see actual English text, which I shall highlight. And this actual English text is a sentence. So now my head moves out of GIS land, out of geographer land. I'm now just using the context of somebody who knows the English language, and I read, U.S. counties generalized represents the counties of the United States in the 50 states in the District of Columbia. Okay, general, blah, blah, blah. So, but, you know, you guys, in case you're wondering, I stole one of Esri's kind of stock, you know, clip art data sets that they give you to get GIS. All right, so the point of this detour being that there's different kinds of context that we depend on to make sense out of data. Right? There's what I'll call, and again, I'm making up these distinctions, I'm willing to, you know, argue these or give them up to anybody who has a better taxonomy of how this stuff should be organized. But there's, in a sense, there's an implicit cultural context that we use for data preservation, that we use for curation. Right? When I showed you that picture of the front page of Halley's textbook, there's at least, you know, there's hundreds of millions of people who can read, you know, 300-year-old English. Probably like a billion people on Earth could read Halley's textbook. They could at least read it aloud, they'd understand the English, they might not understand the astronomical concepts in it, but they could certainly read it and interpret it and tell it from nonsense. Okay, that's huge. So basically, just by putting the data out there in English, we have given up having to provide the context for the English language. It's part of the cultural context. I don't have to ship a dictionary with each, you know, work in English that I put out there in the world. I'm assuming that the culture will curate that for me. Okay. So this is what we're talking here is about responsibilities, about curation responsibilities. Right? We're talking about what's going to get done for me versus what do I have to do myself. And implicit in all of this is we're assuming that the culture is going to curate a lot of information for us. Even to the sense of the culture providing, through allowing people to study things that have no earthly purpose, you know, thousands of people who can read 4,000 1,000-year-old Sumerian, which is kind of mind-blowing if you think about it. You know, there actually is probably more than one pair of people in the world today who can tell each other a joke in Sumerian. Okay. You know, this is one of the oldest languages we have a record of. Okay. So that's an example of cultural survival. We didn't keep Sumerian alive because we wanted to be able to read 4,000-year-old beer receipts. We had other reasons for it, but because of that, stuff written in Sumerian was able to survive. That's an extreme case, but stuff written in English is able to survive because of that. Also, domain knowledge is part of the implicit context. I was using your domain knowledge as implicit context to make sense out of some of that earlier stuff. Example, okay, when we did that dump, before we even had a purge file associated with that shape file, you know, looks like geodetic coordinates, You know, where are your numbers going between, you know, some numbers are definitely between plus or minus 180, and these are between plus or minus 90. What do you think, you know, after a while, as geographers, you just, boom, you just zero in on that. And you just see those things, right? Similarly, you know, I dump this data into a geographic display program. Looks like the good old US of A to me, right? And it is, you know, county files. The lower 48 states, not the 50 states. The metadata lied. I don't have a story to back that up. I'm just telling you, the metadata lied. It does that. Right? Okay. Then we have what I'm calling indirect context. And this indirect context is present. It is supplied, but it is supplied as indirection. It's supplied as a pointer. Okay. Saying that something is an ESRI shapefile or a PDF or something is in effect, pointing to an external standard of some kind. Saying that, you know, I don't have to tell you all about what a PDF is or what a shapefile is. You can go over here and find it out. It's not something that's going to survive because the culture is keeping it alive. It's something that's going to survive because it's part of this domain. It's part of, somebody has assumed explicit curational responsibility for it. Whether it's an ISO standard, whether it's being taught as part of the geographic curriculum. Same thing for tools, like the GDAL tools that we use to poke geospatial data with. Or unique identifiers, like a DOI. We assign a DOI to something. We are, in a sense, saying somebody else is going to curate this identifier for us. It's going to make sure it survives. We're going to assign it to something. And in fact, the responsibility is divided. If you get a DOI, you have some responsibility for making sure that it redirects properly. So for example, if we go back to where we saw that printout that had the projection file information in it. There's a standard for this stuff. One of my favorite standard names of all time, well-known text. Okay, this is well-known. A colleague of mine said it's well-known to those that know it well. But, nonetheless, that's what they call this, well-known text. There's an ISO standard for this particular textual gamish that describes a geographic and combination of geographic and projected coordinate system. Right. Similarly, there is a standard for a shapefile. Okay. And I'm not referencing the ESRI white paper, which is basically the standard for a shapefile, because that just lives on ESRI website somewhere and disappear tomorrow. Instead, I am referencing the Library of Congress's Sustainable Format Registry, where they actually assign an identifier to it that we can use to reference this. And finally, we have a URL we can go to that describes these various tools that we're using to poke this thing with. Now, despite the fact that this guy here has a nice, intimidating international standard on it, okay, any one of these things could disappear tomorrow. Okay? But we're kind of betting they're not going to. For whatever reason, whether it's because an explicit standards body as part of its charter has adopted it, or because a set of tools has become so critical to a particular domain that there is a groundswell of people taking care of it and pretty much guaranteeing it's going to survive, we are outsourcing the curatorial responsibility to those maintainers. Okay. So I have no problem. For example, I don't have any... Let me rephrase this. I would feel much more comfortable about publishing an analysis that was based on GDAL tools than I would publishing an analysis that was based on ARC tools. opinions I have about the relative merits of the two software packages just because our tools are closed and could disappear tomorrow, could change tomorrow for market reasons. These are much less likely to do so, and open versions of them exist. Even if they do change, the original versions are still available. Okay, articles. You know, if we publish text with, we can put DOIs in the text to reference data. This is going through the Dryad system, which allows you to explicitly specify links between papers and data sets, which is really nice. So this is just one way of doing this. There's a whole another talk in here that I'm not going to give about how this stuff works. We just did a paper on this. Okay. But infrastructure exists that allows you to take a data set, assign an identifier to it, and then link the identifier to the paper. Dryad is kind of an independent way of doing it, but a lot of journals do this now for you. Okay, if you submit a paper to the journal, they'll say, put your data here, we'll make the connection. And, you know, whether you trust the journal to keep that alive or not is your business. But in any case, so there's this whole raft of indirect context that we can supply. We pointers to context that's being maintained by somebody else, where we are assuming a curatorial responsibility for that context. We're assuming that somebody else has a curatorial responsibility for it. Is this making sense so far? Okay. Finally, there's explicit context. And when you talk about metadata for whatever it is you're doing, everybody mentally kind of jumps here because this is the hard part. This is the part we have to do some work, okay? But you got to realize that in the broader scheme of things, there's all this other context, the implicit context and the indirect context, that is mitigating the amount of work you have to do here. For naming conventions, unstructured documentation, README files, structured documentation, all of these things are explicit context that's provided. So it can be something as simple as not calling files foo, all right? It would have been a lot easier on me if the files had maybe been called this, all right? Everybody's laughing because everybody's done this, right? I remember I got a frantic phone call from a colleague of mine once who was up in the mountains, and this back and forth cell phone, so he was down at a ranger station talking to me on a payphone, and I feel like I've got to get the dimensions of this particular field instrument I'm using. He was digging pits in the snow. I'm okay, I'm getting way too detailed. Anyway, so where is it? So it's in that file. It's on my desktop. So I've got the phone here, and I'm on his computer. Okay, which one is it? It's called Kaka. You must be kidding. Oh, no. And so I go to his desktop. Kaka 1, Kaka 2. Up to like 37. Okay. Which pile of is the one that you're interested in? So.
Yeah, but, you know.
I'm not quite sure who brought this to my attention originally, but if you think about it, computer systems are structured to basically demand metadata from you at the most awkward times. I want to go home. I want to save this crap and get out of here. It's time to go to the bar. Give it a name. Foo! All right, I'm gone. You know, come on, everybody's done this, right? But to fix that is going to require some re-engineering of how our tools operate. Okay. Get to a little bit of that in a second. Here's that structured documentation we were looking at before. This is, and for those of you that don't recognize it, this is an Esri metadata file. Okay, it's created by ArcGIS. You know, anytime you operate on a layer in Arc, it actually has a standard defining it, which is the Esri profile of what used to be called the content standard for digital geospatial metadata. Which is now ISO 19115, something like that. Nah, it doesn't matter. It's a profile of this particular standard. But point being that in here, there are structured places for you to drop the text that you're going to use to describe what's going on. And the structure basically gives the appropriate semantics to the text you drop in. It says, this particular text is abstract, this is a statement of purpose, this is some supplemental information that, you know, cover that up and it still makes sense. But you add this and says, oh, by the way, don't display this at less than or larger scale than 1 to 3 million. It's a little funky. Okay, so this is all by way of saying, you know, the previous example about what do I name my file, or this big, gigantic, complicated, you know, Esri quad. This gets to what I didn't call these food laws of metadata, but a colleague of mine did, and it has now entered the community with these names, so I have to own this now. I'm sorry. So law number one is that scientists, and I'm going to call you guys scientists now, don't write metadata. Okay? If you have a choice, you will not write metadata. It's just painful. It's not where your head's at. It's just you got better things to do with your time, and that can include vacuuming under the bed. Secondly, any scientist can be forced to write bad metadata. Oh my God, I got to put this in here because of a reporting requirement for my grant or something. Okay, so I'll just write crap metadata and, you know, nobody's ever going to look at it. Alright, so how do we fix this? So our scientific computing environments should create metadata automatically, and they should just be a lot more aggressive about that than they have been. And I have a whole other talk, which I'm not going to give today, that's about how that can happen. It basically involves tracking provenance of stuff that you do online. But, you know, this is really important, is that we are going to have to move towards environments that do as much of this as possible automatically. If you go back and look at this Esri document here, there's a whole lot of gunk in here that, even though it looks like human text, this was put in there by a machine. A human didn't type Microsoft Windows 2000. Holy moly. I suppose 4,000 years from now, there will still be some things running Windows 2000. ATM 2, a couple of airplane entertainment systems. But that was dropped in there automatically, you know, by the program. This was actually written by a human at some point. But if you scroll through one of these things, as I'm sure you guys will run out and do now the next time you get on an article, cool, you can actually go look at the metadata in XML. You'll see that there's a lot of gunk in there that was generated automatically. So a whole lot of this stuff does not have to be done by humans. All right. Secondly, in order to make metadata that makes sense, scientists need to be teamed up with specialists who have domain knowledge. And this is just this part of the whole emerging paradigm of cross-disciplinary science. One of the big disciplines that needs to be crossed is library science and everybody else. Okay, there's a tremendous amount of talent lurking in library science that, with just a little bit of disciplinary sauce added, will make us as scientists a hell of a lot more effective in documenting what we do. Okay, this was not a paid advertisement. This is I actually believe that. So Tony Hay is the guy that coined this, and I don't know if you guys know who Tony Hay is. He was instrumental in getting the science community in Britain off the ground. He used to be the earth science guy at Microsoft Research until there wasn't an earth science Microsoft Research anymore. That's another story. But this is, I guess, the Frew's Laws things is the warning associated with this is be careful what you say around the guy that gives keynote talks for a living. Because it'll wind up in the damnedest places. Okay, let's talk a little bit about preservation. How much time do I got? When should I stop?
You're fine.
Okay. Assuming we've documented everything enough that somebody besides us can make sense out of it, I'll give you a sense of the time horizon, though. I'm thinking a little bit further than that. But let's just say for the time being, I can hand it off to one of my grad students or one of my colleagues and they can make sense out of it. Right, but how are we going to preserve this stuff? All right, well, back to the books. Okay, this is the library of the observatory, and the pictures I took of the books were lying out around here. And this wonderful lady, whose name I've forgotten, actually allowed me to touch some of these books. I'm like, God, no, I can't. No, it's okay. They can take it. Wow. No. Newton held this book. In fact, that's Newton's face over there. That's the death mask of Isaac Newton over there in the corner. It's kind of creepy holding Newton's dead face. Anyway, but, you know, there's books up there that are, you know, 300, 400 years old. They're getting along just fine. Right? obsolete media. So let me share some of the viewpoints and turnouts and things I discovered in here. So we'll take one. Right? 9-track tape. That's like that guy sitting over there. So if you want to go, if you haven't seen a 9-track tape before, except on a science fiction movie, there's a couple of them sitting over there. I don't know how why they're still there, but don't touch them. All right? So, 9-track tape. The ultimate version of this technology would store a whopping 140 megabytes on something that is like, you know, the size of an EP. I mean, these things are huge. This was my bread and butter when I was in grad school. This is how satellite imagery was distributed. We had, the last tape was made in 2002 and the last drive was built in 2003. So you're probably up a creek if you want to try and read that guy. But there's probably nothing important on it, right? Just financial records or something. Anyway, so an archive for this stuff would look like this. Okay, and we actually, this hits me where I live. We had racks and racks of stuff like this. One of those racks, this rack back here, holds slightly less than what would fill this guy. All right, just to give you some sort of idea of what's happened with storage in the past 20 years. So, I mean, it's mind-blowing. Anyway, we had a rack that looked very much like this. It was sitting on a raised floor that looked very much like this. This was back when the floors were like this far off the ground, so there was room underneath it to put all the cables because the computers had wires going between them. Wires, you know, they got copied. Okay, right. So every now and then, and in fact, this was back at a time where buildings were serviced, okay, like people came in and cleaned floors and stuff like that. Every now and then, they would come in and clean the floor. This is what a floor cleaner looks like that can scrub the kind of tiles. And sitting on top of this floor cleaner here, underneath this little floor thingy that can get in the crevices underneath these racks, is an enormous Horkin electric motor with monster magnets on it. Can you see where this is going? Okay? Underneath the tape. I come in after a weekend and go, wow, the floors are clean. And I pop the tape on and nothing's happening. The entire bottom row. this is not a long-lived technology. Okay, this is not 500 years ago Isaac Newton slept with this under his pillow. This is like dead there for a couple of years and erased by the janitor. All right, another interesting technology: magneto-optical discs. I had forgotten about these until I went to this website. We had a whole pile of these. We used to send people down to Antarctica with Macs and, kind of first-generation Macintosh computers that did a lot of the work that pinned down the effects of the ozone hole. Not the satellite work that said there's an ozone hole, but the work that said, and the extra UV is barbecuing the critters in the ocean, okay? So these guys were down there scooping up all this dead plankton and stuff, and they were putting their results on these magneto-optical discs. As of 2010, drives no longer being manufactured. Biggest density drive stores 1.3 gigabytes. Again, 64 gigabytes on here. I haven't even seen one of these guys in ages, but I know back in my lab somewhere there's a cabinet full of these that nobody can bear to throw away. That might actually not have rotten bits on them, but it doesn't matter because there's no machinery left that can read them. All right, last one of these, I promise. Digital audio tape. Okay, this was supposed to be the killer app for digital data storage because it was cheap and it was a crossover between what audio files would use, because everybody recorded on the tape back then, and what computing people could use. So we thought, cool. We set up a satellite ground station, which was receiving data from the ADHR series of satellites, which I think are still up there, but not cutting edge anymore. But we spent years receiving this stuff. And we recorded it all on digital audio tape. And before this drawer was even half full, we discovered that you couldn't read one of these tapes on any drive except the one it was written on. So just a little bit out of calibration is all it takes. Okay? So I guarantee you that none of the drives that those were written on are around anymore. And so again, it's just a drawer that just breaks your heart to go in and throw all these tapes away. So what are we going to do? So, That's not even in my lifetime. This is in a part of my professional lifetime. We have seen at least three storage technologies that were critical to the kind of work I was doing have just gone away. Okay? Anything that's left is gone. So, silver bullet, right? One of the jokes I used to use was there's no such thing as acid-free bits, all right? Because, any bit rocks, any medium you come up with. Well, there's this amazing new technology. I mean, I don't know if this is BS or not, but it was in computer world, so it must be real. They're talking about this technology that uses femtosecond lasers to blast pits and crystals, and, that it's supposed to be incredibly long-lived. Okay, so at least you don't have to worry about the media rotting. And I just, the irony of this was so rich. Can anybody spot? This is basically like that famous CNN headline where it had the story about Sarah Palin getting nominated, right, on the same page as the story about air sickness. Okay. There is a juxtaposition of story taglines here. So I'll just zoom in for you. On the same page, we're talking about bits surviving for a billion years. We're talking about an iPhone. iPhone, okay? I mean, this is recent technology. My wife still has an iPhone 3. She loves it, right? It's effectively obsolete. You can't change your carrier on it anymore. What's up with this? Okay? So even if we come up with this holy grail of storage lasts forever, the whole technology infrastructure that it operates in is fragile. So, preservation implies migration. Okay? We want to keep, process. The documentation is a process. The preservation is a process. Right? You are constantly going to be playing this trade-off as, first of all, just the technology getting better. Okay? Storage capacity is increasing wildly. Bandwidth's increasing wildly. This dingus is faster than any of the old rotary disks I ever had. Okay, I mean, it's actually preferable to record information on one of these USB 3 thumb drives than it is to record it on a rotating disk as opposed to a solid-state disk. So, crazy things like that happen. Cost goes down, capacity goes up, which leads to media becoming obsolete, even if it's still usable. Right? It just be, for reasons that have nothing to do with the fact that the bits are rotting, somebody who's storing information is going to say, I'm going to switch to new media because I'll save money on electricity or cooling. Also becoming really important for computing. I never thought that would be a deal, but the most energy intensive thing in my life would be the server room. New service requirements. Everybody expects us to provide web services on top of our data. That means we're going to have to reformat and store it different. And finally, media rotting. Okay, who's going to pay for all this stuff? I'm not going to answer that question. I don't know. But the thing is doing things like this requires more than just institutional commitment. It effectively requires a cultural commitment. The same way that we made a cultural commitment to libraries, not just institutional. I mean, we have an institutional commitment to individual libraries, but we have a cultural commitment to the idea of a library. Okay, you're going to set up an institution of learning, it will have a library associated with it. It will have curatorial responsibility, at least for the artifacts that the institution creates. But the idea of that having a curatorial responsibility for bits that extends over lifetimes is still something that libraries are coming to grips with. There's plenty of people in this room who can say more about that than I can. But still, this is not a solved problem. All right, finally, let's say a little bit about adaptation and presentation. And again, let's go back to the analog world for a minute. So, how to do this? This guy's one of my favorite authors. When I can't be in Edinburgh, I can at least read Ian Rankin and go to sleazy bars and dribble through corpses and stuff like that. Really cool. That is a cover of the first edition of the book Flesh Market Closed. Right? Repurposed as a paperback because people don't buy hardback books anymore. People, at least crime fiction, will still buy paperback crime fiction. So if you go to the book Waterstones now, that's what you'll buy. I don't think you find hardbound copies of it around. Right? Well, that's a simple media repurposing. It's repurposed for people that don't want to pay for hardback books, don't want to lug a hardback book around, whatever. All right. Now, for those of you that are, in fact, native Scots, I want you to please fight the gorge down, and you see the next slide. I apologize for this in advance. This is what the U.S. edition of Flesh Market clothing looks like. This is an adaptation to an audience that doesn't know what a close is. Okay? Also, it doesn't realize that you're somewhat less likely to get money in Scotland that has the Queen on it. Okay? And if you thumb through it, also discover that people are not familiar with concepts like roundabouts, or trainers, or jumpers. Okay, and all of these words that might cause it, you know, might cause people in America to freak out and wonder what this guy's talking about have been translated. Okay? I mean, this is for real. I mean, I went home and I went, okay, I'm not going to load up on every Ian Rankin book because I can go buy them in the States. No! On my next trip, I left some room in the suitcase and bought, you know, the 5 or 6 ones I didn't have, so I at least get the Scottish one. Alright, so, simple example. Let's get a little more high ground now. Okay, back to Copernicus. Right? I can't read that, but I can read that. Translation in English on the web. This one, the original, gorgeous book, but I got to go up there and probably this time they need to put gloves on. They might not even let me in now that I've told everybody it's up there. But this one I can read on the web. Okay, so repurposed. Electronic, translated into a language I understand. Part of curation is continuing to make the stuff available to the community. All right, wind up here with some slides talking about availability of data closer to where I live, which is NASA satellite data. Okay. If I'm going to go grab satellite data from NASA, I'm kind of old school, so I'll just go grab files. Unfortunately, there's still files. Go grab files in HDF, which is this hideously complex data format that I instantly shovel into a database, but that's another topic. Right? So I know where to go find this stuff. I get that. That's my user interface. That's the user interface I know and love. Some people, not so much. Some people prefer an interface that looks like this. Okay? Form, where you pull out down constraints. You know, what satellite do you want? What product group? Which particular product? And this, you know, where you can see where the little bubble, scroll bubble is. This goes down a long way and lets you constrain all sorts of things to zero in on the satellite data you want. Or you might want something that looks like this. No, I want a picture. I want to draw a box on a map. I want a little Google Earth experience. Okay, so you can have these are all going to exactly the same place. Okay, and again, you know, you and Dina guys, it's your bread and butter, right? Okay, multiple ways of getting at the same information, even including, you know, a few of the programmers, okay? They're an API provided, actual web service API. So you dive into the NASA data using, you know, late 20th century technology. All right, so all of these are examples of the data being adapted and presented to, you know, I mean, this, you know, web services didn't exist when the satellites were launched. Hell, the web didn't exist when these satellites were launched. Yet now the information in them is being made available through this infrastructure that, God willing, will at least become one of the primary infrastructures in the next several years or so. So let's look at what this means in terms of the scope of curation, okay? Are we talking about just the bits? No. We need the hardware to recover what's on the bits. Doesn't make any difference if I got the disks if I don't have the drive that they fit in. I'm going to talk about tape. I need software to interpret those bits once I suck them out of whatever the dingus is. I need the environment that will run the software that sucks the bits. It's starting to sound like the cat that swallowed the rat and so on. And then I need maybe the public-facing services that are built on top of that hardware and software environment. Okay. How, when you think about preservation, these are all places where you could draw a boundary. And you could, in terms of curation, you could draw a boundary and say, in order to guarantee that this service is curated, is made available to other people, you know, how much of this stack is needed? And then, of course, you need metadata for all of it, right? This is a big deal. You know, how's this going to happen? You know, at our university, it's happening in this very distributed way, right? We've got individual researchers. We have online resources that they can consult for help and how to document things and which software to use if they have a choice. Our subject librarians are being slowly trained in digital curation. Larger units, like the research unit that I work in, are actually hiring data curators to work in the units. So basically, if you've got this sort of sliding scale from library over to, you know, research center, sliding out from the library, you have subject librarians that are sort of being pulled away from the library and turned into like a liaison. And then over here in the research units, you have data curators that are being sort of pulled in the direction of a library. The idea is to have this continuum of skills distributed around the university that kind of like in the way you distribute records so that, you know, if one city gets nuked, at least the information survives somewhere else. We kind of make sure that the expertise is distributed throughout the system. And in effect, forming a curation community. So this is just mimicking on the social side what systems like, for example, of locks have done, you know, just basically making sure that information is copied and distributed. So let me feed it. This is my penultimate slide here. Right. So the, as we say in the US, $64,000 question is, how do we make it more likely that somebody born after you die will be able to understand what you did? Because that's really the this is a concept that a colleague of mine and I came up with when we were talking about how do archives how does information migrate between archives? And really, to have a curatorial perspective, you have to think beyond your own lifetime. And in particular, thinking about an absolute gap between your life and the life of whoever's going to use the information. Because that means that the only out-of-band communication is either through the culture or through the artifacts that institutions have agreed to curate, or secondhand through your grad student who says, yeah, he was really a jerk and he didn't document any of that stuff, and sorry, or whatever. But, you know, that unless you have this kind of long-term perspective, you're not going to think about the problem correctly. And also, you know, basically, if you think about it in the long term, you'll also not go overboard in the sense of going, there's no way I can capture all this stuff. I will look around for what stuff is likely to survive in the culture, what stuff is likely to be curated by somebody else, and make reference to that. Okay, like I said, I don't think I gave you any solutions to any problems in here, but I hope I gave you a better sense of what the domain of the problem really is. Okay, which is, and again, I'm happy to discuss this now or in a somewhat more salubrious environment. But let me give thanks to Greg Janay, who's been my partner in crime and curation for many years working on this stuff. We first started working together back in the days of the Alexandria Digital Library, which is one of the first big digital library projects. And then the Peters, who I have called the freeloadees, myself being the freeloader, so I guess the whoever accommodates the freeloader is the freeloadee in terms of my stay here in Edinburgh. All right, thanks.
There were a total of at least six interesting talks in there. Stuck with Adam's trilogy by at least one. Anyway, questions?
Interesting take about curation and preservation as to whether
pits, you don't have. And then the extent to which the curation to some element, which is the information, or it's a form of archaeology.
Yeah, but the bits aren't actually saved. I mean, the poems get transformed. They get transformed. It is just as you said, like the Rankin book.
Yeah.
But deliberately, to make them.
Yeah, to keep, I would call that the bits being saved. Even by copying is saved.
Copying
and translating of it.
Okay. So we had some interesting thing there about translation, wasn't it? So we had it in Latin and then we had it in English.
Yeah.
So that clearly was. So that's the idea that translation is always interpretation.
So Peter, are you saying that these poems you're talking about don't exist in the original, you know, old Brythonic or whatever?
They had no idea.
There's only the English equivalent.
They could only guess at what the original was like. And they're pretty smart, so they can probably reconstruct it fairly accurately. But it's a foregone conclusion that the poems, many of the poems, will not. I mean, I stopped asking the question what the original poem looked like. Yeah, of course, they're a bit interested in it, but nevertheless, there's something there that we can study, talk about, analyze.
Yeah, and you're studying and talking about something different than what the original poem.
In many cases, they are interested in the evolution of the poem.
Yeah. What you're describing there is a situation where the an abstraction of the original content is still interesting enough in its own right.
And possibly more interesting.
So the question then would be, if you're in the case of scientific information, if there is, and this is an interesting topic. This is something I've gone around with several colleagues about, is this idea of scientific equivalence. If you have two data sets that might be vastly different formats, different representations of physical quantities, are they still scientifically equivalent? Say, two different means of measuring a temperature field.
You've already told me about this notice literature, but they, from time to time, improve it.
Yeah.
They take away the old stuff. So if I did analysis and stuff last year, that analysis is in some sense no longer valid.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we sort of live with that, don't we?
Yeah.
In some respects, I think you're making my point, is that the curation is an activity. It's not just putting it in a pile and then saying, oh, I might make this pile more useful, but I'm still going to leave the pile here.
But what I'm saying,
at some point you may say, I don't need this pile anymore.
You copy it and kick it around the universe.
Clearly the more widespread something is.
Yeah.
That's
much more important than trying to push in a nicely organized pile.
I think the importance, what I would extract, if I was listening to my talk, I would say the importance is, if I was listening to my own talk, I didn't find that. So I'm putting myself in the audience and saying that the context is important, but the context is a very complicated thing.
Yeah.
And if enough of the context survives in the culture and survives, one remove from the information, that may be enough. And it may be then just somebody copying the stuff is sufficient to make it intelligible, many, many years from now. Or, we came very close to not discovering the ozone hole in a timely fashion because we were ready to throw away the original data because it looked flaky. There's no way that the ozone values could be that low. Clearly the instrument is miscalibrated. And it was only after somebody went back and went, no, it really is that low. We got a problem.
What you're pointing to there actually is interesting for the sense of which what one takes as direct observational data is not often the data that you wish to save.
Yeah.
Right or wrong. And everybody knows you have missing values because, you've got holes in the data.
Yeah.
And therefore, the question is, do you have an idea in your head that you are improving the data because you're imputing observations because it then becomes computation? And you make you make decisions that you can move that forward with some form of documentation to say what you might have done.
Mm-hmm.
But the prospect of going back and redoing it is pretty near to zero. Because that's what we do in order to move on.
Mm-hmm.
also alludes to the idea about whether you're actually, whether there is saving the artifact is what we're trying to do, which is the case of the beer map or the beer receipt is an artifact in some sense. So we've got fragments of artifact, which might be quite useful, but we actually make a business of abstracting and improving upon it, and that we keep the essence of that in some sense. So it's about the content rather than the actual collection.
Yeah, I mean, if I was studying the economy of Sumer, I would probably want all those beer receipts in a spreadsheet. I wouldn't want a pile of tablets.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah, so I mean...
A history and archaeology is what I'm trying to get at.
The what?
A mixture of history and archaeology.
Ah, yeah.
Where history means documentation, and archaeology means to come across some artifacts of the production. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to remain a question, but is one aspect of the problem of media slightly solved by big server farms and distributed storage? Like the new information we produce, we're not going to put it onto formats, so we're not going to make a drive anymore.
On the one hand, I mean, any transform that makes it somebody else's problem, you might consider a solution. But you know, it's all a server farm is servers that somebody else is running.
But okay. They're not big enough and clever enough that they break the information up, run it across.
Yeah, no, they're
and keep changing them and updating them, and so it's not like you're limited to a particular model of hard drive. They just introduce a new.
Without looking at the overlying business model that goes around that, you know, and the whether Amazon decides to stay in the business of serving anybody except e-commerce next week, or whether Google decides to unplug a service next week, which they do.
Yeah.
Okay. But let's just say that factoring out that part, it's not free. Okay. I mean, you pay. I forget what the cost for a terabyte per year on Glacier is. Do you have that at your fingertips, Peter? Anybody? You guys?
I'll look up David Rosenthal.
Yeah, it's thousands. I mean, it's low thousands to keep a terabyte of Glacier for a year. That idea that the stuff needs active curation is built in. I mean, you're paying for it.
But so and that's good because you don't want to just keep everything.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
It is a business political thing in the sense that the things that you might think exist, right? There's lots and lots of things which now aren't in your library, so if you don't have your journals and things that you thought were full of fixity, you don't have printed maps in your library anymore. You know, there's lots and lots of things that you might presume, and the fact that we've now got a digital, which is really good, because you get real now, etc. But there's a presumption that it's still with the vendor somewhere, and that they are not going to throw away the last copy because they somehow think that they've not yet sold enough. But actually, their obligation to keep it is really... They think they could sell it again. So if you went to a publisher now on that first day, you know, that edition, mm-hmm. or that, and you said to a publisher, I'd like a copy of that, you said, well, I just sold the last copy, you have no right to be upset. Because he said, well, go to a library, stupid. So you go to a library, you won't find it. And that's true of so much of what you now depend upon. And that's a little bit disturbing.
Thanks for a wonderful talk, Jim, and very entertaining. And it is something that we all worry about. I lie awake at night sometimes worrying about such things. And it's interesting, actually, you pointed that cupboard there. Much of your talk was about formal information, formal data sets. That, you don't know this, but that is actually the archive of Belize research in this department up until about 1990. I hope that tape's still readable. There is still a deck downstairs that will read it. In fact, there's about another 2,000 of these tapes downstairs now. But actually, that's formal information. That's kind of what we've talked about. But informal information, actually, very interestingly, also in this room, there's five portraits. And these three guys, who were professors of geography, their papers are preserved in the university. Charlie Withers, my colleague, probably has a filing cabinet with some of their papers in. That's Terry Kopok, who's a name that will be known to us in GIS, started the International Journal of GIS. When he died, I remember secretaries taking files out of filing cabinets and shoving them through the shredder. And the argument was, a legislative one. Oh, the Data Protection Act says we can't keep this, it's no longer of any need to us, I'm shredding them. So his papers went. On Sunday, I'm going round to see the widow of Sandy Crosby, and his papers are kind of sitting there. That's great, there are papers, but for you and I, there are emails on... No, not that I'm famous stuff, you are, but I'm not famous stuff. But there are emails on umpteen systems and umpteen technologies, many of which we've lost. There are every kind of word processor file in a complete file mess. So the historians of the future, actually, history stopped about 1985.
Yeah.
Unless you have formal data that is, as you describe, you can't write about people and their thoughts and their philosophies and so on unless you simply do it on that formal data or these books that Peter says may or may not be in the library. I guess it's a worry, it's not a question.
When I was doing a postdoc at Berkeley, one of my colleagues up there, a professor up there, had like one of those alcoves full of handwritten journals that he basically kept all his notes, despite the fact that this guy was an icon of computer science. He kept all his notes in these handwritten journals, and he had them going back to when he was undergrad. And the continuity of that record was more important to him than using something else that might have been more convenient, because the same discipline that he learned as an undergrad in terms of how you keep a notebook was how he was keeping a notebook now. Whereas, if I went out and said, okay, what's the best way to keep a notebook online? I mean, you want to start a fight? There is no way. Oh, use Evernote. No, Evernote's a piece of crap. You know, or just, you know, plug X in there for any, you know, anything, okay? And there'll be just wildly differing opinions. You know, you won't start an equivalent fight among a bunch of chemists about how to keep a lab notebook. They all kind of agree on how to do it. You know? And so, we don't have the cultural infrastructure yet to support the kind of digital continuity that you're talking about. I think that's a big thing. Your tapes in the basement, you probably don't want to hear this, but this hits me where I live. So about 15 years ago, I was at the National Archives in the United States at a conference on data preservation. And one of the talks was by the tape guy. I knew this cat had to exist. You know, if he existed, he was probably at the National Archives. And he got up, he gave the talk, and this was the guy that knew more about magnetic tape than anybody alive, okay? And he knew how long it would last and how to keep it and how you every year you wind it to one end and wind it back to the other and, you know, don't let it get warmer than this or colder than that, any of that crap. I just was spellbound. All right, yeah, I can't wait, it's something alive. You know, and so this was great. It's the best talk at the conference. So at the end of it, I'd written all this stuff down, okay, you know, not this warm, not this cold, this is the humidity, you know, retention it twice a year. And I look around, and about half the people there looked like I did. They just, you know, word of God, you know. The other half of the people looked like they had just peered into the pit of hell, okay? and they were slightly older, if you lumped them in terms of, you know, so I'm going, okay, this is weird. And this guy looking out in the audience sees this clear partitioning and looks at the older guys and says, now, some of you were here 5 years ago when I gave the talk. I said, yeah. And you probably noted that pretty much everything I said in this talk is not what I said in that talk. We've learned a lot about how to keep tapes around. And much of what I told you in that talk 5 years ago, you probably shouldn't be doing. Because, you know, it takes the failure mode is that the oxide just flakes off. You know, and sometimes it can be to the point where the tapes are fragile enough that the act of reading them destroys them. So you basically get one shot. So if you have tapes that have been sitting in the basement for like a decade...
decades. Tried 3 decades.
You probably want to be extremely circumspect about how you treat them if you actually do try to recover information from them. I mean, you really want to talk to a specialist. You know, I mean, I know of work at the USGS where they actually recovered a data set, and it was like, we're going to spin it, and we hope this works, because we're not going to get another chance. You know, it's going to pile up on the floor as we read it. So, yeah, it's... anyway, I wouldn't bet... Sorry, but I would not lay money.
We did actually successfully. We had to get the guy who wrote them back out of retirement. We did actually successfully extract some rather important data off one about 4 years ago, and it was a 25-year-old tape, I think.
I wish I'd put this in my talk. There is an image, you can go out and find this on the net now, that is the oldest image of the Earth taken from deep space. And it is not the picture that the Apollo astronauts shot out the window of Apollo 8. It's older. And what it is, it's an image that was shot from the lunar orbiters that were sent up before Apollo to make detailed maps of the moon, including the maps of the landing sites. It was recorded on some weird-ass analog tape format. You know, the tapes piled up in a basement, JPL somewhere. And somebody was getting ready to throw them away and went, "Holy Moses, these are the original lunar orbiter tapes. There's probably some really good stuff on it. Maybe a tenth of them have been read, just the ones that were over the areas where they knew they were going to land, the rest of them. There was fantastic information on here." There are no tape drive. Does anybody have a drive that will read these weird tapes? It turned out that the woman who was in charge of the group that had, you know, built the data system for the lunar orbiter, but she retired. There was one of the drives was sitting on the loading dock waiting to get thrown away, and she went, "You know, I'm going to hang on to this." And it was sitting in her garage, covered with a tarp. And so this crew got the thing. They took it up to Ames Research Center, which is where all this stuff wound up. They took over an old McDonald's. Ames used to be a Navy base, so it had a McDonald's and a PX and everything. So they took over this thing, used to be a McDonald's, and disassembled this tape drive, put it back together again, you know, fabricated new parts for the ones that had corroded away, spun these lunar orbiter tapes, and among other things, recovered a picture of it looking back at Earth. You know, so it is actually, it is the first picture ever taken of the Earth from beyond orbit. Yeah?
Yeah. I was just going to say, going back to LOX, is actually what LOX is. So in some sense, it's about lots of copies, different places, but it's more than that, because what David Rosenthal, who writes a very good blog, it's right worth reading right the way back. And it recognizes that electromagnetic information is such that it's on off. We know all that. But actually, part of the rot that takes place is that noughts go to ones and ones go to noughts. And so, although you may read something, you may believe something that you shouldn't believe, because it's plausible that you've still got noughts and you've still got ones, and it looks like the data. And some of that thing may not be fatal in the sense that it's flipped in a way which denies the so-called truth that that says. But if you similarly thought that in a piece of text you were to change the noughts to the nows, in terms of the word not and now, you only change one letter whenever that occurs, but that has a devastating impact on the meaning. Devastating. And similarly, what LOX does as a technology, it's well worth reading, is if you have one copy, then you don't know whether it's right or wrong. If you have two and they differ, you don't know which one's right. So they have an array, maybe six or seven, round about that number. Essentially, it's a form of democracy that happens between these copies. And they therefore come to an assessment as to which one is rotted and then therefore have to recover the position. So it's really, I mean, decorative are something really good, because it gets to the elemental. I mean, things rot over time. You're not surprised about rotten fruit, rotten fish, etc. You know, things do rot over time. And similarly with this data, it rots over time. And we should therefore take some care about a single copy where something like that has gone on. Because it may be that a devastating paper is devastatingly wrong. And it's just too simple to recognize, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, most story systems have ways of correcting for, you know, small number of bit errors. But
yes, if it's a pixelated picture, then you can probably, you know, be okay in the sense that some of it's gone wrong, but you've interpolated across it, and it's okay.
There was a Xerox main line of copiers a few years back, though, that actually did OCR as part of the copying process. So that the way they sped up the copying operation was that they actually printed from, they would OCR like your text and would like actually print an OCR version of it. And the OCR had bugs in it. So it was actually like changing numbers in things that were copied. You know, so you'd copy a 6 and it would come out as an 8, right, because it was scanned wrong. This isn't a copy machine. Okay. don't normally think of as introducing errors like that. So, yes?
Well, computer error becomes historic fact.
Ain't that true?
Well, I won't say anything about Xerox. Machines that we all use and love. Another good one is leaving your CDs on a sunny mantelpiece in windowsill. It wasn't me, but I've seen the replicas. Great stuff. I think just before we draw to a close, it's talking of tablets and beer and such like. It seems appropriate that we will shortly retire to the library bar across the Teviot and do your drinks. So do come along to that if you can. Come and meet people. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to the helpers for helping and set up this mantle. The next talk is actually in June, I think. It's like gap at the moment. June the 3rd. There are previous speakers responded till then. So there is another talk to come. So hopefully we'll see some of you then, bear in mind, before summer holidays. But for now, it just remains to say thank you once again to Jim for a very interesting and entertaining talk. Thank you.